Well, I'd like to welcome you to our featured performance this morning. If this was a movie theater, there would be credits running or something, but it's not. But it is, I think. The Bible is one of the most exciting books that there is. And so we are in a journey on a discovery, a life worth living. We are following in the footsteps of the faith of Abraham and Sarah, who we find in the beginning of the Bible in the book of Genesis, beginning in chapter 12. Abraham, just kind of glanced through a concordance this week. That is, how many verses does Abraham occur in the New Testament? The Bible's two halves, the Old Testament and the New Testament. Oh, let's use one of the ways of dividing. 76 times, 76 verses, his name appears in the New Testament. Significant figure. And someone asked me, are you going to cover all the chapters of Abraham and Sarah's life? By that, it sounded like, I hope you're not going to cover all of them. And I said, well, yes, I am. You know, why not just focus on the main stories? In the New Testament, just focuses really on some of them. But even though it doesn't cover all the chapters, I looked this over again. It assumes that the readers have familiarity with all of the stories of Abraham and Sarah's life, and that all of these stories provide lessons and insight for us in our own journey of faith. That these stories were written down for us. Some of the New Testament writers will put it that way. So there are actually, the first series of stories, there's actually three different stories that we should kind of have in our minds that are actually grouped together in some ways. They are connected. They're a series of three stories. They give us three windows on what life, windows into what life was like for Abraham and Sarah after the promise. Now the promise, if you weren't here, was written Genesis chapter 12, the first three verses. God gives these amazing promises to them that I'm going to use you to be instruments of healing and restoration for the world. Instruments of blessing. I'm going to bless you and use you to be instrument of blessing for the world to solve the problems that are at work in it. And so these are the three windows that come up then. The first story was last week's, we looked at a bit, where it's famine conditions, okay? Or poverty. It's just like, wow, that wasn't really what I was expecting. And then the next story that we'll be looking at today is the exact opposite. If it's famine conditions, now it's fortune. And we'll look at how prosperity brings with it some challenges as well. And then what we'll look at next week is chapter 14, where faith is requiring Abraham to go into a battle. There's a fight that takes place. And so just to keep those perspective, each of these different kind of gives us windows of the variety of responses that is the faith in which faith is required. Now for Abraham and Sarah, the life after the promise proves to be rather surprising, doesn't it? We looked at that briefly last week. I mean, the story starts so well, so full of promise. And if you look at the first verses in Genesis chapter 12, there is Abraham following God, so full of faith as he explores the promised land and he's building altars, that is, of worship to God, calling on God's name in praise and in prayer and in worship. And then, bang, you know, a crisis hits. A really big crisis, a famine of epic proportions. It says it was a severe kavod. It's the word heavy. It's big. This is a big famine. It's a big problem. It was life-threatening. And the story there was both fascinating and puzzling. I mean, I don't know if your groups had a chance to discuss these, but I thought, you know, what should Abraham, should he have stayed in the promised land and trusted God to provide? Like the Israelites got provided manna. Would God have provided manna for him there? Or should he have gone to Egypt, which is what Jacob and Joseph and them went to Egypt in the famine? I wonder, was Sarah a willing accomplice in Abraham's plan to protect himself going into Egypt? Or was she manipulated? How could the Egyptians Abraham feared so greatly as godless people be more ethical than Abraham himself? And why did Pharaoh let Abraham keep all those gifts that he gave because he had had Sarah taken into his household? Why did he get to keep them? Why didn't he have to send all the gifts back? It leaves us with questions. These stories apprentice us in the ways of God, but they do so often not by making explicit moral judgments, saying, oh, that was good, that was bad, that was good, that was bad, that was eh. It immerses us in the story. You know, like Jesus did with the parables. You had to kind of, I wonder. And the writer lets us feel the confusion and uncertainty and dilemmas like the original characters experienced it. And the story invites us to revisit these stories for new or renewed insights. The writer challenges us to work out the implications in our own situations, to practice this living by faith thing for ourselves, with God as the ultimate mentor and his people as some examples along the way. You see, the dark side of the force appears in the famine in chapter 12, and it exposed the fearful side of Abraham, right? Yet unexpectedly, in the middle of this disaster, God miraculously intervenes in ways that, it's interesting, will actually foreshadow the Exodus. Notice, for example, I thought this was very interesting, how God delivers them through great plagues upon Pharaoh and his household. If you know the Exodus story, isn't that the same way? Isn't it interesting? What would it have been like if you're the Israelites and you're reading this story and you're in Egypt? Wow, could God really do that? I mean, he did it then. Could he do that now? And then also a kind of a foreshadow of the Exodus. Notice how Abraham left Egypt rich. Certainly not because of any exemplary behavior, not because he deserved it. And yet the Israelites left Egypt exactly the same way. You can look those verses up in Exodus 3, verse 22, or chapter 12, verses 35 and 36. And then also one other Exodus note before we move on is how, what does Abraham do after his exodus from Egypt? Just look in chapter 13, what we're going to be looking at. He travels to the place of worship, where he meets with God just like the Israelites would meet with God at a special place, in that case, Mount Sinai. So let's read together Genesis chapter 13. So Genesis 13. So Abraham went up from Egypt to the Negev, that is to the south. Negev also means south, it's a desert area most of the time, with his wife and everything he had, and Lot went with him. And Abraham had become very wealthy in livestock and in silver and in gold. We would say he was filthy rich, probably, right? From the Negev, he went up from place to place until he came to Bethel, to the place between Bethel and Ai, where his tent had been earlier and where he had first built an altar. And there Abraham called on the name of the Lord. Now Lot, who was moving about with Abraham, also had flocks and herds and tents, but the land could not support them while they stayed together, for their possessions were so great that they were not able to stay together. And quarreling arose between Abraham's herders and the herders of Lot. The Canaanites and Perizzites were also living in the land at that time. So Abraham said to Lot, "Let's not have any quarreling between you and me or between your herders and mine, for we are close relatives. Is not the whole land before you? Let's part company. If you go to the left, I'll go to the right. If you go to the right, I'll go to the left." Lot looked around and saw that the whole plain of the Jordan was well watered like the garden of the Lord, like the land of Egypt towards Zoar. Well, now this was before the Lord destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah. So Lot chose for himself the whole plain of the Jordan and set out toward the east. The two men parted company. Abraham lived in the land of Canaan while Lot lived among the cities of the plain and pitched his tents near Sodom. Now the people of Sodom were wicked and were sinning greatly against the Lord. The Lord said to Abraham and Lot, or said to Abraham after Lot had parted from him, "Look around from where you are, to the north, to the south, to the east and the west. All the land that you see I will give you and your offspring forever. I will make your offspring like the dust of the earth, so that if anyone could count the dust, then your offspring could be counted. Go walk about the length and breadth of the land, for I am giving it to you." So Abraham went to live near the great trees of Mamre at Hebron, where he pitched his tents, and there he built an altar to the Lord. Well, in this scene, begins by setting the stage. The new episode in chapter 13 opens with an explicit mention of Abraham and his household leaving Egypt. It always uses the language, you go down to Egypt and you go up back into Canaan. Just like we would say, if you're going to Hope, you go up to Hope and you come down. It's not a moral judgment in any way, although some of you think it is. Okay, comparing the last verse of chapter 12 with verse 13, there is one difference. The group of people together, notice the difference is somebody's now mentioned, Lot. Lot is now mentioned as being along with the crowd. He was there before, but now he's got a major role to play, so it's mentioning him and signaling to us. And this passage could essentially be outlined, we'll look through it, as kind of setting the stage for the victory, for the story. And then in verses 5 to 7, it's going to spell out the problem. You don't have to jot all these in right away. I'll give them to you again. But verses 8 to 13, it tells us about, well, how did this thing get resolved, the resolution? And then we hear God's reaffirmation of his promises in verses 14 to 17. And finally, the story concludes with Abraham's response. All the indications in the previous episode, that is in the first window in chapter 12, verses 10 to 20, are that Abraham did not stop to pray about what he should do. Abraham seems to have gone down to Egypt on his own initiative and made his decision based primarily as we heard from him. And whenever you're reading these Old Testament stories, and then whenever there's narrative, it's like, slow down, stop, and listen. Because how people are revealed in Hebrew thought and culture was what they say and what they do. So whenever there's dialogue, and it's the first time Abraham speaks, you listen so we find out what's really going on inside him. And what we heard there was fear. It seemed Abraham seems to be taking everything into account except God, said one writer. And yet God proved to be the decisive factor, the one that could bring him through the crisis, whatever shape the threats took. The opening verses in chapter 13 emphasize that Abraham's journey back to Bethel are a spiritual pilgrimage. He goes back to the altar that he had been. This is going back to where he had encountered God. It is a time of spiritual renewal. Because it underlines this in the verses. It first says in verse 3 that he went. But literally in Hebrew, the idea, the language there is he pulled up stakes. He broke camp and then he set up camp. Which tells us when we travel, you know, a kind of distance, we would just hop in a vehicle and go there. This is telling us every day they had to set up camp and pack up. Set up and pack up. Set up and pack up. Set up and pack up. We did that one summer across Canada. That's a lot different. And every day you got to set up and pack up. Which means he had to have, why are you going back to the center part of the promised land? Back to the, why is that place so important? It's not economics. It's not because he has relatives there. Why? Because God was so real in that place and that space and that time. And he needs deeply to reconnect with God. Because what has just happened to him in Egypt? Some failure and disappointment, and yet surprise at what God is doing. He's reconnecting. And I wonder, what did Abraham and Sarah talk about on that packing up and setting up? Abraham, how could you do that to me? Sarah, why did you go along with it? It was a crazy idea, wasn't it? I don't know. You have things to talk about. Well, now we begin to, in this case, it spells out this problem in verses 5 to 7. We are introduced to a distinctively new challenge, and yet a challenge that also requires great faith. The previous context of famine or poverty, you know, challenges required faith to be exercised in certain ways, and now it's prosperity. Verse 2 informs us that Abraham's prosperity was great. It's the same word used for the severe famine. It's two sides, two different settings. Verse 5 now fills us in with more details about Lot, telling us that, well, he also had flocks and herds and tents. So they are both prosperous, but their prosperity is a problem. Because as verse 6a tells us, the land could not support them while they stayed together. And then the second part of that verse underlines it just to make sure we got the problem. This is the problem. Now this is what we should remind, what I call a good problem. You ever have those? Do you ever say to yourself, that's a bad problem, this is a good problem? I hope you do. I learned this from my friend Toby. Toby has worked in the different parts of the developing world or the two-thirds world. And sometimes Toby will say in the midst of a problem, he'll say, oh, first world problem. And what Toby will mean by that, like you have to have enough and things going your way good enough to actually have that problem. So like a cold shower, you know, somebody used up all the hot water, first world problem. You actually had water for a shower in a home. Like, yahoo! Okay, and now it's set in context. You get that? So we should have that once in a while. You need. Sometimes I think a problem comes along and I think, Toby would say, first world problem, good problem. Okay? We need to hear that, right, in the midst of some of ours. You might want to practice that on people around you. Yet, this was also a growing problem in terms of its size and its scope. That is, it's telling us waiting, hoping it's going to go away, is not going to work. Is he quarreling, it says. And this can be verbal quarreling. The word can also be used of physical involvement or taking people to court even, what it is. But there's conflict between Abraham's workers and Lot's workers. It's spreading. It's not just between the two of them. It's spreading between each of their businesses and families. And the second half of verse 7 gives us additional information reminding us that the Canaanites and Perizzites were still there in Abraham's day, which they wouldn't have been for people in later periods reading the story. And so it's, remember, it wasn't like it was in your day, like it is today, it was the way it was back then. And these two groups, the one group lived more in fortified cities, and the others were more in villages. And so basically, they would have covered a lot of territory in there. And it's basically telling us, I think, that this land has a lot of other people living in it. That's why, even though later on it could support all the tribes of Israel, that's why it's two of these people are having trouble having the land support them. So now, what is required in conditions of growing prosperity and growing conflict? Like, the business is going really well, so well that it's a whole new set of problems. And what kind of faith needs to be exercised? And conflict in the family is a big threat. Amen? It is a big threat. And it's a big threat especially to the fulfillment of God's promises, as this being the family through which all the nations will be blessed. How can faith be a solution to this crisis? Well, let's look at the resolution. I think that we discover that faith provides a solution to the conflict in this setting in at least two ways. And I think verse 8 spells out the first, and verse 9 the second. First, notice in verse 8 the faith-generated priorities. What's uppermost in Abraham's mind? Not the growth of his business interests, right? But his relational interests. He's putting first things and keeping first things first. Family before fortune, or as it's said sometimes on some commercials, people before profits. I remember seeing a story years ago about priorities, in which the illustration given was a rock. A professor actually did this in his class. He had a big glass jar, okay? And some of you have probably seen this or heard about this, but those of you who haven't, you can listen in. And what he did is he had with him a whole bunch of big rocks, and he put the rocks into the jar until it was right up to the top. And he asked his class, is the jar full? Most of them said, yep, it's full. And then he pulled out a bag of sand, and he proceeded to shake that and now fill the jar until it was overflowing with sand. And he said, is the jar full? Well, most of them, yeah, it's full. Pulled out a jug of water, proceeded to pour that into there until that was overflowing. And he said, is the jar full? Well, now they said, yes, now the jar is full. And he said, what's the lesson that I'm trying to teach you? And someone said, if you work hard enough, you can fit more stuff in your life. No, not quite the right answer, though. That's what he said. No, the lesson is, if you don't put the big rocks in first, you'll never get them in later. Priorities. Abraham, if you don't put the big priority first into the jar, and I can remember a season in my life where the first thing that God was telling me you have to put into the jar is your family. You've got to get that rock in there first. Whatever is happening in the next phase, he's got his priorities right. Abraham was very clear on what mattered most and where his options lay, which brings us then to the second part, or in verse 9, the other part of the solution. Verse 9, is not the whole land before you? Let's part company. If you go to the left, I'll go to the right. If you go to the right, I'll go to the left. Faith generated new possibilities, a posture marked by a way of generosity rather than a posture of grasping. I'm going to hold on to my stuff and then get into this conflict. It's interesting. Jesus, in a context of conflict, in Matthew chapter 5, verse 42, will suggest a same. He will suggest the genius of generosity as well in the situation of conflict. You can look that up on your own. Matthew 5, 42. But it's interesting. You know, one reason why generosity isn't just smart or wise, it's genius. And there are many reasons why. I can only point to one. Is because it focuses on the source from whom all blessings flow, not on the blessings themselves. The source, not the blessings themselves. You see, this is a lesson that Israel would later learn in the wilderness, right? They looked at the source every day. Some of them tried to store up and hoard manna, and what happened to it? It rotted. God was trying to teach them I provide for you enough for each day, but not for you to collect and hoard up for other days. I provide for you each day. And this is a lesson that later Israel learned, but they would forget in the promised land how to still keep looking to the source all the time instead of to the blessings that God had provided and then putting the security in that. Remember what Jesus would say about money matters? Matthew 6, he said, do not store up for yourselves treasures on earth. And then he would say what we sang in one of the songs this morning, but seek first God's kingdom and his righteousness, God's priority and agenda, and the things that you need will be given to you as well. And he also warned against greed. On one occasion, there was a dispute, and a person came to him in Luke chapter 12. Jesus gives the response to this fellow. He says, actually, the biggest thing to do is, he says, watch out for greed when you're in this conflict. Watch out. Be on your guard against all kinds of greed. Life does not consist in the abundance of possessions. And if you can get that first, then you might find a way to solve the challenge that you're experiencing. Living by the way of the open hand, by the genius of generosity. That's what God calls him to here. Now, while the story does not consistently focus on Abraham and Sarah as great examples to follow, it's hard not to see them being great examples to follow here and how they handle the problem of prosperity. Abraham lets Lot make the choice, and he does so without any hard feelings. He's not focused on, oh, I knew he was going to take that first. Not at all. Abraham exercises his faith, and the pun is intended. He exercises it. He has to work it. He uses it, right, by trusting God. And Lot, we are told, operates on different priorities. Not so much greed. It could be, but I don't think so. I think what it's telling us is that simply Lot just uses his natural and logical human instincts. He looks and he sees, and that looks like a great place to be and a thing to do. And so he saw that it was good and he did it. It's the same language that's used of Eve when she is in the garden and she looks at the tree and she saw that it was good. I mean, God made it that way. She saw it was good and she took. Only using human perception, if you will. And yet it's clear from verse 12 that the territory chosen by Lot, it lies at the limits. Many commentators say it even lies beyond the border of the promised land. It's definitely into the gray area. It's getting farther away from where God's promised land is, and probably even outside of the limits. And in fact, the story as it develops in Genesis will give us these snapshots of Lot moving farther and farther outside the land until we find him in Genesis 19. Where is he? He's at home in Sodom, in the city of sin. Okay? How did he get there? Well, look back. It would say, follow the trail. And we'll track those moments. You see, Proverbs says, there is a way that appears to be right, but in the end it leads to death. There's a way that seems right, but in the end it leads to death. So what do we do if we should be looking and analyzing and observing, and it's teaching us, well, in your planning, if you're not consulting God, you will never get to where you need to go, because only God can see things that you can't see that are coming. And this chapter gives us some little windows into it. Well, this is what happened to Sodom and Gomorrah, okay? This is where this was headed. And what Lot viewed as a great step forward was to be his ruin, for these cities were destined to destruction. Verse 13 is clear that God knows what we can't see, and that's why we have to trust in him. So that sometimes things are, yep, that's what you're thinking, that's what you want to do, and God says, yep, go along with it. And other times it's like, no, there's things you won't understand, but don't do it. And Abraham trusts God, and is telling us, and this will work out for him in ways that Abraham cannot yet even see. But what God does do is God gives him a great affirmation, a reaffirmation. In this moment where some may say, look what you lost, and God is saying, oh no, Abraham, look what you found. And in the first time in the story, God speaks directly to Abraham. And he says to Abraham, literally, please lift up your eyes and look. Most of your translations won't have that word please. They'll just lift up your eyes and look. It's just a little Hebrew participle. It's used in many different places in the Bible, but only four times ever is it used of God when he speaks to people. And he adds this, please, when he's speaking to people. So it's very rare in those occurrences. And in each time, God is asking people to see with the eyes of faith. So one we'll get to other ones, but that's the important point. The Lord is asking Abraham to do is see with the eyes of faith. I mean, he's looking at the same country that he did before, but now he's looking at it with new eyes, and God is saying, as far as the eye can see, Abraham, I'm going to give this to you. Martin Luther had a genius quote that I heard many years ago, but I have never forgotten. Martin Luther said, God is wanting to give us good things, but our hands are too full to receive them. God is wanting to give us good things, but our hands are too full to receive them. Abraham's generosity was genius, a genius way to solve the conflict, but it proved to be even more genius because of the great reward God was able to give into those open hands of Abraham. The former promises here are reaffirmed and raised even higher, if you notice. Now it underlines the whole land, he says, forever. And in verse 16, he will say, and the descendants, they are going to be you. Nobody is going to be able to count them. They're going to be uncountable. And he sees with new eyes. Well, what's Abraham's response? Abraham's response is to move. You know where he moves to? Pull up a map here. You can see Sodom. That's where Lot was moving to. Most think that's in the valley area there. Abraham moves into Hebron, into the center, if you will, of the promised land. It's symbolic and significant. And it says not that he just sojourns. There's a different word when you're going and you're living somewhere temporarily. And then there's another word in Hebrew when it says you're making your home there. Solid. He's settling in there, into this place. And he builds an altar to the Lord. To remember this moment, the genius of generosity, when God surprised him by being even more generous than Abraham by far. What challenges are you facing in your life? Maybe you need to think about priorities. Are the big rocks really the big rocks at your home, at work? How's your attitude, your posture with a family member or with a colleague or a neighbor? Is it a posture of patience? You know, usually when we get into a conflict, we lean into it, right? And so what does the other person have to do to kind of keep balance? They got to lean into it too, right? And in this case, I wonder if Lot, we're meeting, there's a family meeting to talk about the business, whether he was preparing for this and ready to lean into it. I don't know, but it must have caught him off guard to lean, and there's no pushback. It's like a posture. You know, so your kids, they're not quite on time again. You go up to their room. They already know what posture is coming, right? I practiced that this morning too. It's like I'm preaching on it, and like, oh, Dave, that's not quite right. You're going to talk about this today. What if you did something different? A creative, open, humble posture. Maybe that's the genius of the response that's needed in the situation in which you're finding self. Instead of grasping, maybe give. It's not the only response that faith ever needs to take. There's three stories here. We're going to look at a very different story next week, but it should be in the tool belt of our responses. Faith should generate the possibility, the genius of being able to be generous in attitude, in approach that gives space and room and necessity for God to show up in the midst of our lives. So I want to invite you this morning to practice the posture that Abraham practiced here in his faith, a posture of open hands. As we pray, let's pray. Lord, we live in a world that has a posture of grabbing and grasping and clinging, and we learn those lessons so well, and it becomes like second nature to us. It's the natural instinctive response. But Lord, you call us to be patient, to be open in our planning, to make you as the decisive factor, not just to go and make decisions based on what we think is best, without consulting the one who knows all things. Lord, may we be open in our planning, in our posture with others, and Lord, especially in our posture to you. May we live the way of the open hand, Lord, so that our hands are not too full for the things that you want to give us. Things that may be material provision, but Lord, they may be things that are even more deeply valuable, a restoration, a reconciliation. Lord, teach us to live the way of the open hand.